Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tuesday's apparent contentious phone conversation between President Obama and Afghan President Karzai, and look into whether any kind of settlement is possible before the US and NATO deadline to pull out of Afghanistan at the end of the year. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, joins us to discuss Obama's bitter divorce from a corrupt partner he inherited from George W. Bush and his threat to leave no troops behind to stabilize a country that cannot pay its way and is likely to fall apart. Then we'll look into the decision by Ohio's Republican Secretary of State to suppress Democratic votes by cutting early voting on weekday evenings and Sundays to block the black church's Souls to the Polls voting drives. Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics and Justice and professor of political science at Ohio Northern University, joins us to discuss a flagrant attempt to limit African-American voting in this year's midterm elections, in which low voter turnout helps Republicans. Then finally, we will speak with Joe Comerford, the Executive Director of the National Priorities Project, about the 2015 defense budget, which does not translate into less spending when you add the extra $26 billion Obama is expected to ask for, the extra $115 billion over 4 years Hagel is proposing, and the $85 billion Overseas Contingency Operations slush fund. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She is also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you to have me again.
And President Obama apparently had, I assume it was a contentious phone conversation with Afghan President Hamid Karzai on Tuesday. And it was the first time they'd spoken since last June. That would indicate to me that this is not a particularly functional relationship.
No, and you'll recall that really from the beginning, it hasn't been. I remember in 2008 when I was in Afghanistan looking at some governance issues, it was pretty clear that the previous Bush administration had really been part and partner of the rigging that went into the 2009 election that again returned Karzai to the presidency. By the time Obama became the president and sort of realized what was going on, it was really too late to turn that back. The train of electoral malfeasance had sailed, and I mix that metaphor deliberately. And you'll recall that even upon their first meeting, Obama wasn't terribly excited about Karzai. He gave him quite a reaming on the corruption issues, the consistent blaming of the United States for various things while not condemning the Pakistan Taliban, and of course, heaping various accolades upon Iran. So this is really a continuation of what I would call an inherited marriage between Obama and Karzai, and of course, Obama inherited it from the Bush White House.
And do you think that had he known what he was dealing with, that he wouldn't have made that statement in his election campaign, where he effectively rhetorically dug a hole for himself, where he said the Iraq war was a mistake, we took our eye off the ball and we should have concentrated on Afghanistan, effectively said, I'm going to fix Afghanistan?
Well, so look, that was, I think, a huge strategic mistake on Obama's part. And I think the even bigger mistake on his part was really conceding to the general's demand that he authorize the surge. It's pretty clear from the things that Bruce Rydell has written, from various statements made by the president, as well as things that were leaked about him in his decision-making process, that he was very dubious that any number of troops could prevail in Afghanistan with the kind of leadership that was available in the Karzai government. And we can debate the origins of this corruption. I mean, I would argue that much of the corruption that exists is, again, due in good measure to the way in which the United States built that government, the way we've done aid and so forth. That's a whole other issue. But, you know, it is my belief that Obama understood that the surge was going to fail. And you'll remember at the time, and I believe you and I had even discussed this on your show, Vice President Biden was really putting forward this notion of counterterrorism plus, which was rather than trying to stabilize Afghanistan, build some competent state and so forth, that we were really going to work on the things that most threaten us, and that is Al-Qaeda and other international terrorist groups operating from Afghanistan as well as Pakistan. So I think Obama really made an enormous miscalculation by eventually throwing himself half-heartedly behind a policy that he did not support, and worse yet, knew was not ever going to be effective. And so I think, you know, he's just going to have to make some margaritas out of some pretty lousy lemons right now, knowing that the preferred citrus fruit is, of course, a lime.
So, Christine Phair, then, given that he inherited this marriage from Bush, and now it looks like he's asking for a divorce or threatening a divorce, what kind of leverage does he have in the divorce settlement, Obama?
So, look, the leverage is quite simple. I mean, it's simple, but yet it's at the same time not simple. So Karzai, you know, there's going to be an election in early April of this year, so it's right around the corner. Even though most of the candidates support this, the Loya Jirga supported the bilateral security agreement. By all accounts, his own military commanders want him to sign the bilateral security agreement. Karzai doesn't want to take responsibility for that. And what he's saying is, let the election happen, and whoever wins, let them take it on. This is not a brinkmanship that's going to really come out in the favor of Karzai. From everyone I've spoken to, Obama's preferred preference is the zero option. It's been his preferred preference for quite some time. The military, of course, wants to have some residual 10,000 training force into place. But Karzai doesn't seem to understand U.S. military planning. You have to begin to plan to withdraw, or you have to begin to plan for some sustaining of some residual force. Now, I suspect that what's going to happen is that we're not that far away from the election. Whoever wins the election will probably sign the BSA, if that's where the prevailing winds are, and we'll be back to this position of having like a 10,000-person training force, you know, left over in Afghanistan. But it's also entirely possible that this new person that comes in, whoever that may be, doesn't want to sign the BSA for the same reason that Karzai doesn't want to sign the BSA, and we're back to the zero option. In my view, I would like to see the zero option. I don't think there's anything to be gained by continuing to have a military force in Afghanistan, and obviously without the BSA. Now, legally, we have other agreements that would allow us to keep troops in place. But without the political cover of the bilateral security agreement, any residual force staying in Afghanistan would really be redolent of something that looks like an occupation. I don't think anyone wants that to happen.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Phair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So the zero option you're talking about is just no boots on the ground altogether. We're completely out of there, right?
Well, let the chips fall. I think people confuse not having a military presence with completely out of there. I mean, so what no one talks about, and they should be talking about, is that the international community, led by the United States, built an Afghan government that is absolutely unsustainable. It is a bigger government than that which the Soviets built. This means that the Afghans cannot even pay the recurring costs, much less the actual cost of maintaining this government. So, you know, speaking to the leverage of Karzai or whoever comes after him, there is going to be the reality of what happened to Najibullah. Najibullah was in place when the Soviets militarily withdrew, so there were no boots on the ground, but the Soviets kept writing him checks until, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed. When those checks stopped coming, Najibullah was unable to pay those patronage networks that kept him alive. He spent the rest of his life, all 4 years of it, holed up in the United Nations compound until the Taliban killed him in 1996. So everyone understands that without a source of funding, this Afghan government cannot pay for itself. There's really no other way of saying it more clearly. It is simply incapable of paying for itself. So what the Afghan government wants is, of course, the checks to keep coming, but it doesn't want the provocation of a military presence which is both liked, tolerated, and loathed, depending on who you are and with whom you talk. So that, and I think from the point of view of the international community and from the American public in particular, it is true that we have recurring and large military financial commitments to South Korea, but that's because we have a very large military presence there. When we no longer have soldiers in Afghanistan, I think it's going to be very difficult to get subsequent Congresses to keep writing the checks to keep this Afghan government afloat. And that Karzai has to understand. He's not nearly as foolish as people think he is. He understands tribal politics. He understands his dilemma. And most importantly, he knows his own history. And all he has to do is look at pictures of Najibullah, you know, hanging from the street post eviscerated to understand what his future or the future of his successor could very much look like.
Assuming he doesn't get out of the country beforehand and join his money in Dubai.
Well, so he's got his own personal equities, right? So it is absolutely true that thanks to the American taxpayer, more money is hoovered out of Kabul than is its gross domestic product, which just tells you what's happening, right? Money's coming in the guise of aid, and it's being hoovered out in the guise of theft. So it is true that he's got multiple nests that are feathered throughout the world, but it is also true that I'm sure he doesn't want to see the country devolve back into what it was in the 1990s. But you're right, since he's got his own various plan B, C's, D's through Z, he does have an escape hatch. But whoever is going to be sitting there in the palace when that last check gets cashed is going to be thinking pretty hard about Najibullah and what happened to him.
So, Christine Fair, what would the, if assuming the other, short of the zero option, they go with the notion of maybe 10,000 troops supposedly train this military? I've read reports where if the U.S. and NATO leave, up to one-third of the Afghan military would probably desert under fire. There was also the recent incident where the Taliban shot about 30 Afghan soldiers in their beds, and apparently there was some intelligence prior to that that wasn't either passed on or listened to. So, you know, I'm not sure what the utility of these Fort Apaches would be.
So that's basically my sense. My sense is that we really replicated in Afghanistan what we did in Iraq, which is we really came to building police and so forth really late in the game. The means by which we trained and set up these security institutions were completely inappropriate. I mean, again, I think you've had numerous shows on this, the various defense contractors training police, the systems that we've used to train these folks. We could go on at length. Absolutely a fool's errand. On top of which, we insisted upon having a number. It's changed a little bit, but at one point it was as high as almost 400,000. Now I think they're looking at something around 300,000, which would be the size of the standing Afghan National Security Force. This is a preposterous number. There is absolutely no reason for Afghanistan to have a number that large. Now, had the Americans been thinking about the future and about economic sustainability as well as regional viability of this whole enterprise, they should have been really pushing Karzai to come to some kind of modus vivendi with Pakistan on the Durand Line. Without an agreement on that international border from Afghanistan, Pakistan is never going to stop the nonsense that it perpetually engages in Afghanistan. So if the United States was able to broker some sort of modus vivendi, and it could be anything from, you know, stopping short of Afghanistan accepting the Durand Line, but certainly agreeing to not make it an issue anymore and to undertake bilateral initiatives that would essentially treat the Durand Line as a border, there's no reason for Afghanistan to need a security force that large. So the first thing is, it's not sustainable. As you noted, the vast majority of them are poorly trained, likely to defect. They don't have logistical capabilities. They don't have lift capabilities. They don't have search and rescue capabilities. They don't have any of these things that you need to be functioning on your own. All of these so-called support but ultimately critical activities are supplied by NATO, NATO ISAF, and obviously led by the U.S. So I have very big doubts about what's going to remain. And what I think is likely to happen, because we've already seen some of the politicization of the Afghan National Army, is that it's going to, at least on the margins at first and perhaps more thoroughly, disintegrate into a bunch of militias, which is, you know, not unusual given Afghanistan's history. So rather than having a national army, I think we could expect over time, without money and without good leadership, which I don't think we should expect either, I think we can expect this relatively large army to basically break up into a series of militias under the leadership of local commanders, which is what it was in the 90s, more or less.
So in terms of Pakistan, though, they're already having negotiations, the government, with the Pakistani Taliban. And my understanding is that the military weren't thrilled about this, but what the agenda of the Pakistan military is basically that they let these talks go ahead, and if they fail, which they're likely to do, then they've got the excuse of really hammering the Pakistani Taliban. And also I understand that there's a dawning recognition in Pakistan that the Americans are leaving, that we won't be able to blame them anymore for everything. And I can't imagine that any rational politician in Pakistan wants the Afghan Taliban running Afghanistan, because that would give aid and comfort and perhaps even join with the Pakistani Taliban, and that would make Pakistan even more unstable.
All right, so I think it's more murky than that. So first of all, the Pakistanis this week, actually beginning last week, did commence pretty serious air campaigns in North Waziristan after the Pakistan Taliban beheaded nearly two dozen frontier corpsmen. So the army basically told Nawaz Sharif, you know, shove it, we've got some aerial strikes to conduct. The information that's coming out about those aerial attacks, not terribly clear. One thing you don't hear about are the civilian casualties. I guess you're only a civilian casualty worth mourning if a drone kills you. So the army is going ahead with this, but I see nothing that distinguishes it from the past operations, which is where they basically mow the grass, retreat, accommodate the political demands, to engage in some kind of negotiation process, which inevitably, again, break down and causing the cycle of military intervention to begin anew. Going to your point about the Afghan Taliban, here's what I think Pakistan prefers. It wants some degree of the Taliban back in Afghanistan. Under the U.S. security umbrella, the Indians have been able to resurrect themselves. The Pakistanis believe Indians are behind every development in Pakistan, rightly or wrongly. That is what they believe. But they don't want the Taliban to be in a position of domination, as you suggested. And this is really for two reasons. One, the possibility of, as you noted, reverse sanctuary, that the Pakistani Taliban could have sanctuary, as they already are having, in Afghanistan. So attack in Pakistan, retreat to Afghanistan, right? Payback is quite horrible, and Pakistan anticipates that it's going to get payback for what it's been doing to Afghanistan for decades now. But by not having the Taliban be in control, I think the Pakistanis are assessing that the militant groups which are currently targeting the Pakistani state will go back to Afghanistan and fight with the Taliban, as they did in the early 90s, throughout the 90s, but first helping the Taliban to get control over Kandahar and then to consolidate their position throughout the rest of Afghanistan. So I think what Pakistan's hoping will happen is that all of these groups that are targeting the state, once they are no longer cooperating with the Americans in a provocative war on terror, even though their cooperation is far from optimal, those groups will turn their guns in Afghanistan against the remnants of what they think is a Western imperial propped up regime. I don't think that's going to work, as the Pakistanis think, but I do think that's what they're aiming for, which is a weak restoration of some kind of Taliban governance that will keep the Indians out, but also not have so much sway that Pakistan's own militant groups won't be drawn to go over there and help them fight.
And would that be a picture similar to the Afghanistan before the U.S. intervention? I can't believe that the Taliban will take all of the country. Won't the Northern Alliance be revived?
No, so I don't think the goal is it. I don't think Pakistan's goal is that they will retake the country anytime soon, if ever. Mm-hmm. But what they do want is there to be a cause for their own pro-Taliban militants to stop fighting the Pakistani government and go over and support their, you know, basically they're co-religionists. They all mm-hmm. come from the same religious ideology, the Deobandi movement with this cluster of mosques and madrasas. So I think that's the calculation. I think the general idea that Pakistan doesn't necessarily want a Taliban running Afghanistan is true, but I think it likes the idea of there being some Taliban and with enough space that they can fight over.
And something of a magnet to get their jihadis out of their country and have them swallowed up in what sounds like it could be a perpetual war.
Yeah, I think that's probably what Pakistan would prefer, all else equal. What it doesn't want is a relatively stable Afghanistan that is close to India, close to Iran. People forget about Iran, and therefore hostile to Pakistan. Pakistan would rather have a chaos that it can calibrate or thinks that it can calibrate than a relatively stable country that has really close ties with countries like Iran and India that are hostile to Pakistan and vice versa.
Well, Christine Farah, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Farah, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about Ohio's Republican Secretary of State's flagrant voter suppression plan.
اون دو چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنی نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College and draws upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past three elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Alexander.
Hello, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And your state of Ohio, a key state, very much the key in the last election and essentially all of the elections that I can remember recently, the Secretary of State, John Husted, announced Tuesday that he's cutting off early voting on Sundays and weekend evenings. And this appears to be targeted at African-American voters who participate in church services on a Sunday, and it's they've had a program for some time now called Souls to the Polls, where they get driven after the church to the polls. In 2008, black voters were 56% of all weekend voters in Cuyahoga County, which is Ohio's largest, even though they made up just 28% of the county's population. So it looks like the Secretary of State is really targeting that vote.
Yes, absolutely. I think the African American population in the state feel particularly disenfranchised by the recent actions. As you mentioned, the Souls to the Polls drives have been a staple, particularly of African American churches on Sundays, to mobilize voters to get to the polls. The fact that our large African-American populations are, of course, in the cities here in the state, will most likely depress voter turnout, particularly for Democrats. Houston is a Republican, and so this is seen as a real power grab, I think, to disenfranchise Democratic leaners and voters, and would then work to favor Republican candidates.
But we saw in the 2012 elections voters facing extremely long lines at polling polling places in Ohio. And, of course, that year was when early voting in the state had been reduced from 5 weekends before the elections to only the weekend right before Election Day. And now, just about a week ago, Governor John Kasich, the Republican governor of Ohio, signed 2 GOP-backed bills that cut 6 more days from the early voting period. And it would seem to me that, I guess my question is, how do they get away with it?
Well, I was talking to my class just the other day about, Democrats seek every means that they possibly can to make voting as easy as possible. And Republicans oftentimes are seen to find ways to, in this case, some would say, restrict voting and certainly restrict voter turnout. And then the reason is because it either affects one party one way or affects the other party the other way. Democrats benefit when more people get out to vote. Republicans benefit when less people get out to vote. And so, in large part, this really has nothing to do with trying to make sure that our voter lists are accurate or that the right people are at the polls. Really, it's about trying to secure your party's strength. And so, in this case, it's Republicans trying to curb voting, not make it as easy. You had mentioned weekdays until 5 o'clock. Well, one of the real benefits to voting early is that most people have jobs until 5 o'clock. So, wouldn't it be nice to be able to vote after 5 o'clock? Well, that's not the case according to this legislation, as well as the weekend voting. So, Democrats definitely benefit when you remove barriers to voting. Republicans typically benefit when there's when voting is a little bit more difficult to achieve.
But, I think what we're talking about, at least what bothers me is, by fair means or foul. I mean, if you can't inspire your people to vote, that's your problem. That's politics. You don't have a good message. But the idea that you deliberately erect roadblocks and do all kinds of backroom machinations to target people that you don't want voting and make it difficult for them, it seems to me that crosses a line. That isn't, that's active voter suppression as opposed to, I guess, passive voter suppression, which would be to just discourage people in general. Oh, they're a bunch of crooks, don't vote for them. And apparently a lot of Americans feel that way. There's a lot of voter apathy, as we know.
Well, I mean, you hit on something really important, obviously. I mean, we've got 90% of Americans that don't approve of the way that Congress is doing its job. It's hard enough to get people to the polls. And certainly in 2014, in this midterm election, this is going to be a lower voter turnout election in the first place, certainly far lower than a presidential election. So it's already going to be difficult to inspire people to get to the polls. You erect a few more roadblocks in the way, it's not only do you not have inspiration, but you also have problems getting the vote. And so, you talk to people about this kind of thing, and I think they share your frustration. Well, why would we make it harder for people to vote? And I think certainly Republicans would say that we're not trying to make it more difficult. We're just trying to make sure that there's a uniform way that it's handled so that in some counties it's, we're going to allow some people to vote. In other counties, we're not going to allow other people to vote. So they're going to make the argument, Republicans are, that they're trying to put something in that's more uniform, and we don't want voter fraud, which a lot of evidence points that there's very little voter fraud that actually occurs. But those cases where we do see it, I mean, that frustrates people too. So, they have an argument to make, but I think that a lot of Americans say, wait a second, let's try and make voting as easy as possible. We want people to go out there and cast their ballot. I mean, this is democracy in action. Why make it more difficult? In 2014, we're going to have a governor's race here in the state of Ohio. So, as you mentioned, Ohio's a crown jewel. It's a really important state, and 2014 will be seen as somewhat of a barometer for how the state will move in 2016. And so, John Kasich, the Republican, I was a speaker at the Republican National Convention, so he's certainly a Republican stalwart across the country. But in the state of Ohio here, he's had some controversy, certainly early in his term. His opponent, Ed Fitzgerald, is a former county commissioner in Cleveland. Well, Cleveland is going to be one of those areas that would be hit the hardest by this new legislation. So, again, it could play itself out not only in congressional elections, presidential elections, but certainly in our next election for governor.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Robert Alexander, the chair of the Department of History, Politics and Justice, and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College and drawing upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past three elections. Back to Houston, the Secretary of State, the Republican Secretary of State of Ohio, the key voting state in many ways, particularly in presidential elections, that I think the statistics prove that if you don't win Ohio, you don't win the presidency. Houston, back in 2012, he tried to cut Sunday voting and tried to end voting on the weekends and the Monday directly before the elections for everyone except service members who tend to be to vote Republican. And that scheme failed because the Obama administration, or the campaign, I suppose, sued and won in court. So what are the legal remedies then? The ACLU are already apparently objecting to this new voting rule. What can be done to overturn the Secretary of State's rulings?
Well, I think that you hit the nail right on the head, and there will be legal challenges forthcoming. What those legal challenges will ultimately determine are anybody's guess. And obviously, back in 2012, they did not permit the curbing to the level that Houston's office had wanted. And, you know, there's a kind of a symbolic issue that you want to think about as a member of certainly of the state and as a citizen is, you know, if there's going to be a question here, we'd rather have people vote and then discount it rather than not have them vote from the very beginning. And Houston's challenger, Nina Turner, has gotten actually a good amount of national attention in recent years, and will be a real spitfire, and this will be certainly a rallying cry for her. She happens to be African American, so I'm sure that will stoke a lot of excitement, agitation, all kinds. You know, you pick your adjective there in that race.
Well, she's been a staunch voting rights supporter, and it looks as though this is personal with Houston. If he's targeting the African-American voters and preventing the Souls to the Polls convention that's been going on for some time, where on Sundays after the black churches empty out, they arrange rides to go straight to the polls, you can't help, without being conspiratorial, you can't help seeing a link here. A guy that's running against an African-American voting rights advocate, the Democrat Nina Turner, the Republican Houston, seems to be doing what he can to prevent his own defeat.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting thing because, you know, the way that the Secretary of State's office works in many states, and Ohio certainly is included here, is that it is an elected position. And, and many of them often take on roles within their parties as well. And, you know, Ken Blackwell, a former Secretary of State here in Ohio, happened to be George W. Bush's campaign point person in the state while he was Secretary of State. And that, you know, again, symbolically, whether or not you're being conspiratorial is one issue, but you know, it doesn't help the efficacy that many voters either feel or don't feel. First of all, they look at, you know, what government does, and they go, I don't know if I buy into what, you know, whether or not it really matters in the first place. And then you have these kinds of shenanigans that take place. It just doesn't bode well for democracy. I'm sure that Nina Turner will take this issue up in the race. And, you know, then we'll probably have a layer of, what level does race play in the campaign? And you know, whether it does or it doesn't, it that adds a whole other dimension to the campaign.
Well, but clearly, Robert Alexander, that's already happening, the racial element. I mean, on Tuesday, at the Naval Observatory, the Vice President's residence in Washington, D.C., Vice President Biden was honoring the African American History Month, and he criticized the voting rules in North Carolina, Alabama, and Texas, saying that they were motivated by racial hatred.
Right.
And just quoting the Vice President, "These guys never go away. Hatred never goes away. The zealotry of those who wish to limit the franchise cannot be smothered by reason." So taking what the vice president said, It would seem to me that if the Secretary of State of Ohio is using reason and all kinds of excuses about voter fraud and creating a level playing field, which seems extremely hollow in the face of the fairly flagrant evidence that this is targeting black voters, maybe it is time to take the gloves off and call it like it is. Is there any indication that Biden's words are going to fire up the Democrats?
I think that this is, in these elections where voter turnout's probably going to be relatively depressed anyway as a midterm election, you know, people are looking for reasons to get others out to the polls. And so certainly for Democrats, this is a prime reason to say, look, they're trying to take your rights away. Don't let them. And so if there's anything to kind of, you know, poke the bear, so to speak, this is the kind of issue. And so, you know, Houston, it could be obviously a ploy to try and depress voter turnout among his opponents. But at the same time, it might be, ironically, something that actually spurs greater turnout because of the issues that it presents.
Well, you know, just in closing, Robert Alexander, when you look at the figures from 2008, when Obama swept in and the Democrats took the House and the Senate and the White House, I think over 140 million people voted 2 years later when the Democrats got blown out and lost the House and lost Senate seats, only about 75 million voted in the midterm. So, you know, there's a lot at stake for Obama in this midterm election. You know, he could be a lame duck pretty quickly if the Republicans take the Senate, and most indications are that they'll hold on to the House. What's your sense of Biden's, you know, words notwithstanding? Are they going to treat this like a presidential election, do you think?
Well, I think President Obama has already started to move in such a way, you know, in part to help his own legacy, but also in part to help his party. He really doesn't want to do much to hurt the Democratic chances moving forward in 2014, and so he's tried to take on a tack to paint, you know, Democrats against Republicans, obstructionist Republicans, and so he recognizes that his legacy certainly will depend upon having Democrats in the Senate and more Democrats in the House to stem Republican opposition. So he's really tried to pivot over the last few months to do what he can to try and help his fellow Democrats out. He doesn't want to hurt their chances. And so I think he will share the vast resources that he has at his disposal in fundraising. I think that he will share the vast resources that he has at his disposal when it comes to campaign and voter mobilization. And so they have micro-targeting down to a T, and they're going to do what they can to get people to come out to vote, particularly in places like Ohio.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Alexander.
I very much appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Alexander, who's the chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice and a professor of political science at Ohio Northern University. His most recent book is Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, which examines the Electoral College drawing upon surveys of presidential electors he has collected with students over the past three elections. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the smoke and mirrors and sleight of hand in the 2015 defense budget. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joe Comerford, who is the Executive Director of the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Comerford.
Thanks so much, Ian, for having us on.
And it looks as though the 2015 defense budget that was just announced by Secretary of State Hagel is really a sleight of hand in terms of the idea that he came in as a guy that was going to cut the waste, fraud, and bloat at the Pentagon. Because if it doesn't seem to translate into less spending when you add the extra $26 billion Obama is expected to ask for, the extra $115 billion over 4 years that Hagel is proposing, and the $85 billion Overseas Contingency Operation Slush Fund.
Indeed. You know, I think there in the narrative, in Hagel's narrative, there was a lot to celebrate. It's in the actualization of that that there's actually a lot for us to be fairly alarmed about. And just as you say, there is an unbelievable disconnect between what Chuck Hagel says he's doing in terms of downsizing the Pentagon and what the numbers tell us in terms of how much Pentagon spending our nation will do. So, in fact, the story is about troop cuts, and we should take that very seriously, right? Because there are women and men in our nation, and they're maybe slated for reductions, but some of the larger, very expensive weapon systems and or other kinds of investments in long-term militarization of our nation, they are not going away. In fact, as you say, we're going to actually exceed the spending cap of sequestration if projections play out by $115 billion over the next 5 years.
So why is it then that the idea of that the Army will be smaller than it was before World War II, why is that getting all the headlines?
Well, you know, I think it makes some logical sense, right? We're in narrative right now, we are ending the Afghanistan war, right? I know that that still has to be actualized, and that's quite a hot topic right now as well. But even if we leave 10,000 U.S. troops there, it is still a very much smaller conflict than it has been. And we know that the 21st century threats to security range from anywhere from climate change, which I think we should take more seriously, to much more decentralized. And so we don't need this big footprint, and I think military footprint, and I think it makes a lot of sense to Americans that we don't need this. And so I do think that the media has snapped it up. Also, I do think that as a nation, we're hungry for this news, given the kind of austerity that we've experienced as a nation. Because right now, $1 spent on the Pentagon means $1 is not spent someplace else. So there is this moment of absolute, you know, zero sum. If we're going to spend it here, we're not going to spend it there. And so I do think that that caught both media and community members' attention in thinking that perhaps there was a new day for this big, giant Pentagon that takes now 57% of all discretionary spending.
So, Joe Comerford, the eliminations of the weapon systems are, curiously, they are the weapon systems that have been the most effective and the most useful for the military, particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, not that anybody's sanctioning those wars. The A-10 attack jet, they're finally getting rid of that. The U-2 spy planes, which they still use, that goes back to the 1960s.
Right.
And the reduction in some of the Navy's littoral combat ships, which they've been spending a lot of money on and still haven't developed one that works and doesn't leak. But to my mind, the greatest obscenity is is the F-35, which is the world's most expensive weapon system in the history of mankind. And it doesn't work as well as the planes it's replacing, and it doesn't work as well as it's advertised because stealth is a big hoax now. The Russians have their radar to detect it. So all it means is all that weird coding and angles and stuff supposed to deflect radar, all it does is make the thing unflyable. And the only reason it flies is because of the incredible amount of software aboard those planes. The whole thing... And when you consider they're getting rid of weapon systems that worked and replacing them with incredibly expensive ones that don't work, that's where I think the outrage should be directed.
I agree with you, Ian. I think it's outrageous that the F-35 in this proposed downsizing of spending, which is, of course, not happening in actuality, the F-35 should come first. Right now on National Priorities Project's website, if folks went there, they would see that we are spending as a nation just for this year, just for 2014, $964,006. And right now, every hour, $964,006 just for the F-35, just for this year. And that, as you, and then that's an enormous sum. That's the United States. That's our tax dollars. You and me, through our, you know, through our individual income taxes.
Say that again. For every hour, every waking hour that all of us go through, how much are we spending on this damn thing?
$964,000.
$964,000 every hour.
And it was actually $964,006. But every hour of every day, 24 hours a day, 365 days. And it's, as you say, it's the most ill-gotten, arcane system. And all told, you know, the number, as you, I know well know, is over now $1.5 trillion in total weapon cost. And it is an outrage that we are still locked in this. And it has nothing to do with security and everything to do with contractors and their relationship to members of Congress. And it is this kind of ill-gotten relationship that I believe that people need to be pushing against very, very hard as the president delivers his budget before the nation.
And again, I'm speaking with Joe Comerford, who's executive director of the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. Now, the nation's premier news and investigative program, 60 Minutes, did do a piece recently on the F-35, but I found it extraordinary that it was not particularly critical about it, and it more or less was spinning the story in the way that this new Secretary of the Air Force has finally got his hands around this program that's been out of control, but now he's got his hands around the program, but it's still going ahead.
Yeah, I thought that was troubling as well. You know, I think in one moment, Hagel is saying that conflict doesn't look the same, you know, that it's decentralized, that it's going to be fast-moving, that it's going to come in very non-traditional, if you will, forms. And then another, they're producing the weapon that, in fact, they've been producing now for a very long time, for a conflict that is no longer takes the same shape as that weapon was, you know, defined for. So it's, and then on top of it, to have the weapon never work as accurately as anybody needs it to. It's just, it's an obscenity. And we're hemorrhaging money every second, every actually millisecond of every day. Americans are hemorrhaging money because of this weapon system.
So what are the, in terms of, you know, there's always been this dichotomy in the Pentagon between the toys and the boys. And the toys always get all the riches, and the boys, now of course it's the boys and girls,
right,
get shortchanged. So what's happening in terms of reductions in military personnel, active duty, Army, National Guard, Army Reserve and Marine Corps, the pay freeze for flag officers and generals, and a reduction in benefits for active duty personnel and their families? So let's deal with what's actually happening to the boys and girls as opposed to the, you know, open snouts in the trough, raid on the Treasury for the toys, particularly this F-35 Turkey.
Right, indeed. So the Army is looking at, you know, just under 100,000 jobs lost. That's active Army, active duty Army. So they're about 520,000 now, and they're looking to go between anywhere between 440,000 and 450,000. It's just under 100,000. And, you know, that's, we don't know yet how that's going to, what impact that's going to have on specific bases, but clearly that's, you know, many, many American families will be affected by that. Similarly, the Army National Guard is going to lose about 20,000 members, the Reserve about 10, the Marine Corps about 8, but Special Ops is going to gain about 4, and that's consistent with past Pentagon statements where they've seen outfits like the SEALs, the Navy SEALs, as being highly effective, or the Rangers, highly effective. So, and again, that actually more tracks with, again, dominant theory about warfare, which is what we need is not the big, huge footprint, but we need to move quickly with fairly sophisticated capacity. So that tracks with that theory. Again, you know, there's there's almost no money going into conflict resolution or prevention, as you well know, which is, you know, needs to be tried. And then the upper crust is getting pay freeze. Those are the flag officers and the generals. And in fact, you know, I think this was a good recognition on the part of the Pentagon. A lot of this was good narrative from Hagel. It's just the playing out of it that there is so much disconnect. But recognizing that there was it was fairly top heavy. But then again, active duty folks are the benefits are going to be reduced. And that has to do with housing allowance, and it has to do with reducing subsidies and containing health care costs. Now, the tricky thing here is, I know you know this, enlisted personnel makes so, their wages are so low that many of them actually are eligible for means-tested benefits nationally, like food stamps. So there is, again, a real disconnect, and you say, I think rightly, the disconnect between the boys and the toys. So these personnel, you know, these women and men are going to be further constrained at the very, very bottom of this pay scale when, in fact, this $964,000 expenditure will continue per hour. So that's a look a little bit at some of the personnel shifts. What they're not talking about yet fully is how this is going to be operationalized, and what they're not yet talking about fully is this the force structure or the global footprint of the United States. You know, so there's a lot of open questions about what does this mean for our U.S. bases across the world? What does this mean about any prospective bases that they've been considering and things like that?
But it would seem, though, Joe Comerford, that the basic headline that after 13 years of war, the U.S. Is downsizing its budget to $496 billion. But then when you look into these budgetary games that are going on, as I mentioned, Obama's expected $26 billion extra.
Hagel's, which is also going to non-defense discretionary, too, but he's just splitting this boost equally.
Right. That was the so-called compromise, right?
Right.
And then the extra $115 billion over 4 years that Hagel is proposing, and then the $85 billion, the Overseas Contingency Operations Slush Fund. Where's the real number? That's what I'm asking.
Well, there isn't a real number. And here's one gruesome example of that. So you'll remember last year with sequestration, right? It was the first year, right? We were going to tackle it as a nation. And you'll remember that the Pentagon and the FAA, you know, the air traffic controllers, right? The wealthy didn't want to wait in the airports, and so we allowed the FAA some wiggle in managing its funds and cuts. And then the Pentagon said immediately, red alert, we can't deal. And it also got some wiggle. So we have done some work here, and it's still a little bit of a preliminary figure, although I can get behind it in about 99% of myself. So last year, between the wiggle that the Pentagon got and some of the other cost savings and some of the slush fund that happened with the 14 budget compromise, the Pentagon actually only dipped by about $3.5 billion after all of that drama and all of the crying poverty. And that leads me to say to you that unless great media like yours and the American people demand more transparency and accountability on the part of the Pentagon, these kind of shell games that the Pentagon's doing are just going to be repeated in the 15 budget, and it's what we must not allow. Because the Congress and frankly the White House is so predisposed to listening to the cries of poverty of the Pentagon and so predisposed not to want to shake up the status quo that they are doing monumentally bad business with regard to the Pentagon budget.
But also, none of these numbers and these budgetary games and this shell game that's going on ever gets to, or the Emperor's clothes question's never asked in terms of what do we need it for, what are the threats on the horizon. And frankly, there aren't any national threats anymore since the end of the Cold War. There are certainly subnational and transnational threats, and as you mentioned earlier, they tend to be addressing them with special forces, etc. But my understanding is that, and you're just saying if you cut through all the smoke and mirrors, it's only comes down to about, you know, $3 billion extra. So there's no dividend.
For a loss of $3 billion.
A loss of $3 billion for ending 13 years of war. There's no peace dividend, right? But the question that I wish somebody would ask and would answer is how this relates to what we spent at the height of the Cold War. Aren't we spending the same?
Oh, we're well over the Cold War average. No. When we adjust for today's dollars, we're spending well over the Cold War average. No, there's been no adjustment yet or no quote-unquote peace dividend. Or, you know, we're talking, there's a lot of national conversations and good work being done about transition economy work, you know, to transition this economy into the new economy that we need, which will be the jobs of the 21st century that tackle 21st century threats like, frankly, like poverty, like global poverty and or climate change. Right, those are really among the top 21st century threats that we face, or water shortages. We're not in the same position as we were, as you well know, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s. It's just we're in a totally different nation. Our military, our Pentagon, has not pivoted there yet, and it's actually to our peril.
Well, apparently the intelligence people and know about this. They know that climate change is, and you know, all you have to do is look at countries like Australia, where the interior of the country is getting so hot that the kangaroos can't even go there anymore.
Right.
And there are endless studies showing that there'll be massive dislocations of populations, and much of the world's bread baskets and rice growing will go underwater, et cetera, et cetera. The nightmare scenarios are out there, but I suppose they'll just ask for more money, right? I mean, it's not like the peace dividend is the smoke and mirrors. It just hasn't happened, and it's not likely to happen, right?
Well, it's not likely to happen unless we can force it to happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, I am holding out hope, and perhaps I'm a dreamer. But I do think that this moment is very, very different than the end of the Cold War. We've been through a major recession. The country is slightly more politicized than we've been, certainly than we were. Slightly more plugged in. Our Congress is monumentally badly behaved.
Right, and the public have just recognized that these last two wars have been complete catastrophes, and they've done nothing but make the world mad at us and make us less secure. So I agree with you. The time is ripe. I just hope you're right, and I thank you, Joe. We've run out of time, but I thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. Thanks for your work.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Joe Comerford, who's Executive Director of the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.